It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. All right, we're joined here today with Mark Bray, author of the brand new book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Mark is also the author of Translating Anarchy, the Anarchism of Occupy Wall Street. He's a longtime historian and anarchist, and he's joining us today to talk about his brand new book tour, about the book, about anti-fascism, the media, and also what's changed since Charlottesville. Mark, can you get us started and tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm a historian of modern European history, currently a lecturer at Dartmouth College. I'm also a longtime anarchist and activist. I was involved with Occupy Wall Street, union organizing, and a number of other issues over the years.
You've got to be getting this question a lot, but when you wrote the book, did you fathom that you would be in the middle of just all this talk about anti-fascism, the alt-right, and Antifa?
Well, I kind of figured that to some extent, the fact that many anti-fascists are reluctant to speak to journalists, speak to the media, would mean that to some extent I would be attempting to try and convey their perspectives on their behalf. But of course, the craziness of the post-Charlottesville situation was far more than I ever could have expected.
Yeah, I imagine so. But it's also great to at least have somebody out there that has a book and is going on a tour, and we're going to talk about that tour right now. So can you just tell us about the tour? What is the goal overall, and how many cities so far have you visited?
Yeah, so the goal with the tour is really just to familiarize people with what anti-fascism is about if they're unsure as to what the whole message is, the whole strategic focus is, to meet with organizers, anti-fascist, anti-racist, to try and discuss sort of a larger historical contextual context for thinking about organizing. I had the fortune to meet with some anti-fascists from Virginia who helped organize the counter-protest down there and discuss their perspectives. And in a certain sense, as you alluded to, what I'm trying to do is convey the perspective. So they shared some things from their organizing that they wanted the media to know that wasn't being reported and so forth. So last month in September, I was on the East Coast down to Georgia and back up. This month in October, I'm heading out to Pittsburgh and Michigan, Chicago, Minneapolis, and then coming back to the East, and then November out on the West Coast.
When you're going to these talks, who all is coming out to these events? What is the mood like, and what kind of questions are people asking?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. So when I do like DIY or radical bookstore talks, it's largely leftists, but not just anarchists, anti-authoritarians, but, you know, folks from DSA, progressives, Green Party people, Bernie people, like new left liberal types who are sort of not sure what to make of this. So, you know, I always get a question or two about, well, what about the civil rights movement? And so, to a certain extent, the whole proposition of anti-fascism is forcing a lot of leftists to rethink their really preconceived and one-dimensional notions of what violence and nonviolence is and how successful protest movements operate. Also, I get, you know, just the basic questions about speech and violence and strategy and the efficacy of anti-fascism. So it depends, but for the most part, people are very curious, and I've been shocked on wood as we speak that there actually haven't been any real serious hecklers or serious disruptions. I think in part because it seems like the far right finds me to be incredibly boring, and I'm fine with that. So we'll see how that turns out.
Yeah, I saw in, I think it was DC, there was a post on DC Direct Action News saying that there was some talk that the far right was going to show up and disrupt the event, but they never showed up.
Yeah, no one has showed up to any of my events, and hopefully that continues.
Right, at least outing themselves to be as such.
Yeah.
I know like people like Gavin McInnes or Mike Cernovich have kind of said that one of their goals is to draw a line between kind of people in the center left or progressives and anti-fascists. Do you think that that has worked at all in the current moment, or are you seeing people instead kind of coming over to our side?
Well, I think that there have been efforts at that from all directions, you know, probably most notably really from liberal pundits, from your sort of average New York Times left liberal columnist or what have you. But I think that there has been a successful push, not just from self-professed anti-fascists, but from more militant anti-racists in general at pushing back against trying to separate people who are opposed to fascism and racism, building bridges, turning to successful examples of mobilizations that have brought out thousands of people. And I think that there has been a fairly successful push towards saying, okay, well, you know, you may not agree with certain tactics or methods. They may not be things that you as a progressive want to partake in yourself. But, you know, when shit's on the line, you will be well served by having anti-fascists next to you. And certainly the comments made by Cornel West and other clergy in Charlottesville, and the thanks that were given by the organizers of the counter protest in Berkeley a couple weeks ago, the thanks to the Black Bloc for showing up and pushing the far right out of the protest, are examples of some of these bridges being put into place, I think.
Thinking of the tour itself, can you share something that has both challenged you, anything maybe that you previously thought before you went on the tour, and also something that's been further cemented afterwards?
Well, I guess I'll start with this, the further cemented. You know, I wrote this book to be useful as much as I could, and that's why it's called a handbook. Whether or not handbook is the ideal name for it is a matter of debate, but the purpose was to make it historically useful, to flesh out some of the ideas of anti-fascism, and the book is based on 61 interviews with current and former anti-fascists from 17 different countries in North America and Europe. So I really tried to take the perspectives of anti-fascists, put them forward, and let them speak for themselves as much as possible. And so I've met a lot of anti-fascists and anti-racists who have thanked me for essentially making some of these voices available, and also from their perspective, trying to put forward the arguments that for one reason or another, they may not be in a position to make on a big scale themselves. And so that I was hoping that the book would be helpful in that regard. And a lot of people have said that it has. And so I'm happy about that. As far as other kinds of unexpected things or challenges, I mean, I expected that these talks would be shit shows of like disruption, not only from the far right, but even from liberals or even from the quote unquote peace police type people. And really, it's been rather chill, rather positive. And even people who have shown up, I think, to really present confrontational questions have really been disarmed by my willingness to really debate them in a respectful way about issues that sometimes inside drive me crazy. But really, it's been, I think, a positive experience, and I'm optimistic that some minds have been changed in the process.
That's awesome. Can you give us some examples of things that people have asked kind of in that vein?
Sure. So like at my presentation in D.C., there was sort of veteran of the new left who was, you know, had their politics very well steeped in the civil rights tradition. And she was saying that, you know, the revolutionary politics of anti-fascism risk throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And from her perspective, the baby was sort of the gains made by social struggles, civil rights and so forth. And that if you create a revolution and you destroy capitalism in the state, then all these gains will be thrown away. And so it was a little bit of a muddled question, but I really tried to talk with it through her, talk through it with her about how actually revolutionary politics are behind a lot of the progress that we've made, and that creating a new society would further those kinds of conquests. And at the end, she bought a book and thanked me and chatted with me afterwards. And so, you know, it's one anecdote, but to the best of my ability, I'm trying to not just present these perspectives, but try to bring more liberal types on board with the legitimacy of collective self-defense against the far right, whether or not they themselves may partake in it.
Well, we're going to switch gears a little bit here. So BuzzFeed has just released a bombshell that shows that Milo solicited information and content ideas from neo-Nazis and white nationalists, gave them creative control over the content, let them read it over, has a strong relationship with the millionaire backers in the Mercer family, and also took steps to distance himself from the outwardly racist elements of the alt-right while still having a close relationship with them. What is your response to these emails that have come out in BuzzFeed, and what do you think it actually says?
Well, I mean, prior to this, of course, the divide in the media was that, you know, there were folks such as It's Going Down and others who were like, look, the connection between the supposed alt-right and the alt-right is very clear. The connection between all of these milieu through Steve Bannon, through Sebastian Gorka into the White House is very clear. And so, you know, when people try to quibble over whether or not Milo Yiannopoulos is racist or what have you, you know, it's really missing the bigger picture. And then, of course, there's the other side of the media that insists on, like, unless you have a picture of Milo Yiannopoulos, like, killing a person of color, he's not a racist.
Right, right.
And so hopefully this will be a huge bombshell in that kind of dichotomy to make people realize that just as in the 1920s and 30s when fascism and Nazism grew in Europe based on its ability to win over traditional conservatives and landowners and industrialists, and how back then the line between being a fascist and a traditional conservative was blurred every day, that today as well, you have these kinds of layers and layers of disgusting fascist and white supremacist and so forth politics connected more and more to people with money, people with influence in the media. And I hope people will just give up on trying to defend Breitbart and Steve Bannon and Milo Yiannopoulos, because the connections are super well documented. And the next time that Milo says he has nothing to do with Richard Spencer or with fascist or racist politics, people will just not believe him because it's absurd.
Do you think that's going to happen, though, or that he will continue to?
Well, I think it's a step, but, you know, those of us who have followed these kinds of things in the media know that, you know, it takes a lot more than one step. And the way that society defines things like racism is so narrow and the burden of proof is so high that sometimes it's takes a lot more than one piece to do it. But I think it is a step. And also the larger conversation is not just about the facts and the evidence, but the political context. So, you know, as many listeners probably know, the Free Speech Week out in Berkeley was a fiasco. It didn't happen. And the sort of the fear mongering around the counter protest against Milo back in Berkeley in February, that shutting him down will simply like escalate his ability to be master of the universe, hasn't really come to pass. Right. You know, right. His book did not sell as well as it thought. The Free Speech Week didn't work out. You know, his profile is declining, and that's true of other figures as well. So this is all, of course, also happening in a context where organizing is short-circuiting his ability to really be a meaningful figure.
Based on what you've seen and people you've talked to, do you think that anti-fascists should like focus energy around these kind of alt-right figures? Because it is bizarre, because they do kind of position themselves like outside of the alt-right. But if you look at somebody like, I don't know, Lucian Winterest, who writes for the Gateway Pundit, I mean, he's still getting information for his articles from Poll and like sharing it on Twitter and stuff like that. So they're never like very far removed.
Yeah, I mean, I try not to go too far into saying what individuals or groups should or shouldn't do. But it does make sense to focus on these folks in whatever way organizers think is useful, because, you know, the part of the danger with fascism or white supremacist politics is sometimes not just those who are very clear about it, but those who try to build bridges between these kinds of politics and groups and more traditional conservative and mainstream parts of society. And these alt-right figures were sort of playing that role. And you can see clearly that Breitbart has established a very significant readership, and is, you know, one step away from your Fox News into your sort of mainstream media. And so the ability of figures like Milo or whoever to be able to bridge that gap is important. And focusing on, you know, the information that this article and others have put forward that, like, look, there really isn't that much separation or any separation between the Daily Stormer and Milo and all these other people. It's just sort of a continuum is really important, even if it'll take a while for a lot of people to listen.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it's a good step. And I mean, none of this stuff is new. I mean, like Ann Coulter has been sharing and quoting from VDare. I mean, there have been people at Breitbart that have gone to and tried to speak at white nationalist conferences and stuff like that. Another turn here. The far-right media reacted quickly after the Las Vegas shooting to try and connect anti-fascists to the massacre. What does this say about the far-right that they're just so quick? I mean, there's a video going around of Alex Jones talking to Paul Watson, and he stops the conversation and says, I just got a text from law enforcement. They said that they raided the room that the shooter was in, and there was Antifa stuff everywhere and pictures of Middle Eastern countries. And then he says, I'm deleting the text right now to get rid of the evidence. But I mean, what does this say about like their drive to just really try to connect anti-fascists to this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just imagining Alex Jones's phone, and it has like auto dial number 2 law enforcement, all of law enforcement on the phone for Alex Jones.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so from what I've heard from people that have been monitoring the far right, they basically had no idea what Antifa was, you know, as of, I don't know, 6 or 9 months ago. And then all of a sudden, that's the big boogeyman that all of their attention's focused on. But they really don't understand what it is for the most part, it seems. And so all they can do is kind of make recourse to their one method of kind of cyber or media combat, which is trying to take the worst thing they can find and associate their enemies with it. And, you know, they'll do that against Hillary Clinton. They'll do that against the Democratic Party. They'll do that against anti-fascism. And to some extent, it's a variant on some of the kind of far-right attempts to smear Occupy Wall Street or Black Lives Matter by finding some incident and trying to weave it into this narrative. And it's just weird. And the most frustrating thing from my vantage point is the mainstream journalists who like are, oh, hey, what do you know? Alex Jones or the far right say this was an Antifa. Is it? Question mark. It's like,
right.
This should not be a source. This should, you know, this is the Daily. This is a National Enquirer. Like, this is not, you know, if they say it, then probably the most reasonable conclusion is like, okay, that is definitely the opposite of the truth. And so, you know, there's really not much to say other than they're confused, ignorant, desperate, and are really sort of one-dimensional in their responses to any kind of political opponent and any kind of sort of major crisis that they think they can lump people into.
Right. It's like somebody from CNN once asked us if we could prove that we weren't funded by Soros. And, you know, we told them, like, well, you could actually go and look and see what, you know, where money from his foundations is going and realize it's not us. But, yeah, it's insane that
right. That
people, especially in the center, are so somehow put off by anarchists or anti-fascists, but yet they look to the far right, you know, to kind of like set the bar. Really,
yeah, and the other thing is that apparently, at least initially, a lot of the far right just couldn't believe that anti-fascists were not on a payroll. They couldn't believe that someone would put this much time into trying to organize against them if they didn't have a monetary incentive. Which says a lot about our society and the like narrowness of our vision of why people would do things. And also I think it shows that the fact that people are willing to believe that George Soros would be psyched about it's going down shows that, you know, the kind of political spectrum of how people see politics, that the left is just sort of a kind of a grayscale and not understanding how revolutionary anti-capitalist politics are really a different conversation from, you know, trying to create a welfare state or elect Bernie Sanders is really shows the poverty of the intellectual conversation around politics in the country.
Keep streaming me. Someone,
I'm streaming.
So get someone to stream me.
I got it. I got it, Banks. I got it. I got it, Banks.
What is my people saying? What is my people saying?
Damn that sucks.
I need more milk.
Damn that sucks.
I need more milk.
Damn that sucks.
I need more milk.
Damn that sucks.
Right, man.
Damn that sucks.
Right, man. Vake, it's gonna hurt for a second. Vake.
Keep streaming me, someone. Keep streaming me, someone.
Need more bell.
Look for babies.
You know, in traveling to these different places, do you feel that the far right has had any influence over just kind of how the public sees Antifa, which has sort of become this kind of catch-all term that could mean so many things?
Well, what I've noticed most is the lingering notion that anti-fascism is really just the same as fascism, that the extremes are the same, that by shutting down a far-right speaker, it makes you a brown shirt. So that's a question that I get now and then, and you know, it's been promoted by figures like Dinesh D'Souza and others who say that the real fascists are on the left, and you know, it's sort of a more, I wouldn't say more thought out because it's really not thought out, but a more long-winded version of the Alex Jones far right, you know, this shooter is Antifa because I hate this shooter and I hate Antifa kind of thing. And so, you know, it's pretty easy to make it clear that fascism and anti-fascism are completely different once you start talking about it. But that is kind of a boogeyman I've had to deal with now and then.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the media. You've been talking to lots of journalists in Charlottesville. What would you say the main misconceptions in the media are, and what are the various factions in the media trying to get out of these misconceptions?
Right. So, I mean, one is that Antifa is a specific organization with a specific kind of chain of command and a leadership, right? So talking about it as, depending on one's perspective, a kind of politics, a kind of activity, a kind of tendency or milieu, rather than one specific thing, explaining that anyone can form their own Antifa group, but then also clarifying that there are fake Antifa media accounts and trying to explain that, yes, anyone can form their own group, but these fake accounts are fake because there is no group and they're right-wing trolls and so forth. And trying navigating that has been part of the conversation. Also, another misconception is that Antifa are essentially kind of like violent kids who just like wake up in the morning and say, hey, there are some people I disagree with. Let's go fight them.
Right.
You know, which is pretty much literally how a lot of these journalists thought about it, at least in the beginning, and some still do. And trying to explain that, you know, this is a huge time commitment. This is a risky endeavor. People put a lot of their time and effort and risk a lot by doing this kind of work. They put a lot of time into strategy and thought, you know, all the things that most of your listeners already know, I'm sure. And also clarifying that there's so much more to what they do than confrontation, and explaining what that is and how that works. And so there's so much to get through before you can actually even have a reasonable conversation about the strategy, tactics, and history. And that's most of what the media has been looking at. Although it's interesting that probably over the last week or 10 days, when the kind of peak frenzy around anti-fascism in the mainstream media has declined somewhat, most of the journalists that I've gotten in touch with have more of a sincere interest in trying to actually figure out what's going on, which has been mildly refreshing. But whether they accomplish that or not is another story.
Why do you think what are they trying to get out of these misconceptions? I think a big question is, you know, looking back at kind of the turn that happened after Berkeley on August 27th, why do you think that, you know, people within, especially the centrist and liberal and even sometimes leftist media, really chose to kind of like draw that line against anti-fascism? Why was that important for them? What did they hope to get out of that?
Well, I mean, I guess there's two sides to it, right? One is looking at the media as, you know, an industry that thrives on clicks and readership. And, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. It's much more profitable to portray this as a kind of, as Chris Hedges essentially said, kind of a bloodthirsty lust for violence among disenfranchised youth or something, rather than a much more really mild-mannered politics of everyday research and everyday fact-finding and doxing and organizing boycotts against venues and so forth and so on. So in that sense, you know, there is kind of an industry standard, and that's how anarchists are almost always covered and have been for decades, is that kind of focusing on the spectacle and getting readership based on the spectacle. But the other side of it is that, you know, journalists like to think of themselves as objective, but that notion of objectivity is really groundless, and you can see it most clearly when they're covering stories that they're allowed to be explicitly biased about under the guise of neutrality. So what I mean is, if you have a left of center journalist who maybe even writes about the far right or Richard Spencer, whoever, in a way that's like, well, I'm just going to present the facts and just let them speak for themselves. When it comes to confrontations against neo-Nazis and white supremacists that violate allegedly freedom of speech, that violate allegedly our societal norms about peaceful protest, then they feel justified in condemning it in a way that they don't condemn much more heinous things in the other direction. And so, you know, it's a lot of people's personal politics played out in a kind of industry context where this kind of spectacle sells. And really, it's layers and layers of ideology resting upon the sort of economic imperative of the industry, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. What would you say are the main media narratives that anarchists and anti-fascists need to be fighting in the current terrain, and how should we go about doing that?
Well, you know, I want to be sensitive to the notion that there are and have been Antifa groups that simply don't give a shit, and I understand why that is. And right, so that's important to put at the start, because the mainstream media can never be entirely won over to this, and any successes that we have are temporal and fleeting. But to the degree that people want to make that effort, I think that one is making it clear that these kinds of strategies and tactics can work. They can work today. They have worked in the past. There is a historical track record of this working, because at the end of the day, I think that's really the key issue, is that this can stop the far right. This can stop Klan groups and Nazi groups. And in fact, I'm not sure what else really can. And so I think that's obviously one thing to put across. Second is certainly the range of what anti-fascism entails, and the really thoughtful time that's put into figuring out how to combat these groups. And what else? And just, you know, that there's a whole number of different kinds of people that do this. There's an attempt, I think, by the mainstream media, but specifically, I think, certain liberal identity politics people to make it seem like these are just sort of like angry young white men on steroids, and get across that it is a much wider range of people from all sorts of backgrounds who have an investment in defending them and their communities and vulnerable populations from these heinous monsters. Those are a few things that come to mind. But, you know, again, it's a matter of how important we think the coverage of the media is. And, of course, there's a range of perspectives on that.
Yeah, I guess from our perspective, just like, you know, its ability to shape people's perceptions, and then those perceptions being a problem. So I was more speaking to how can we kind of like circumvent those narratives, like within the broader population, not necessarily within the media itself.
Yeah, sure. Right. And that's an important distinction to make. And certainly I think that the best way to kind of inoculate people against the misleading narratives from the media is to do the work and form relationships in communities, in workplaces, wherever, so that people will know what anti-fascism is about in a personal way, and be able to see a news report that distorts it and say, that's not true, because I know what these people are up to. And, you know, part of that is Charlottesville, part of that is Berkeley, and making these connections in a way that people will hold on to for the rest of their lives, and that encourages these forms of resistance. And yeah, I suppose that's the best way to move forward.
Just with everything that you've, all the people you've talked to in the media, do you still think that it is a smart move for anti-fascists or even people like yourself to continue to engage with the media?
Again, I think that reasonable people can disagree about that. And so I'm certainly not trying to encourage people to engage with the media when they've given up. If they've given up, I understand. But I am going to continue to try and explicate the rationale for this politics and try to present the perspectives that I have gathered from doing my interviews, because even if much of the media will distort it, even if a lot of people won't pay attention, some people will pay attention. And, you know, getting some people to understand and some people to participate is useful, because you know, we need people to take this threat seriously, to organize against it in whatever ways make sense in their time and place. And yeah, I mean, I suppose that, that's what it is, because, you know, everyone gets into this kind of politics one way or another, and putting out as many opportunities for people to come into contact with these kinds of ideas, I think is useful.
So in all the people that you've met on the tour recently, what do you think has changed the most since Charlottesville, and what hasn't? Based on what you've seen in people, also, what strategies do you think that we should be thinking about within the current terrain?
Sure. So, all right, so what's changed since Charlottesville? Well, I think the seriousness of the conversation, especially pertaining to the seriousness of the threat of the far right, I think has changed for people that have shown up to these book talks. And there is, I think, a real urgency in thinking through how to fight back. And regardless of how what people think that should look like, there's an urgency to have the conversation and to hear different perspectives. And I think this is an issue that a lot of people maybe weren't taking that seriously. And now, at least those who show up to the book talks, which, of course, is a self-selecting group, they are taking this seriously. As far as what hasn't changed, I still think that, on the one hand, you have this urgency for thinking of ways to fight back. On the other hand, for at least some people, there is that kind of the barriers that come in with whether they recognize it or not, a really liberal understanding of rights and speech, and also a liberal understanding of nonviolence and violence and how social change happens and what kind of resistance, what forms resistance can take. And so there's sort of like a deeply ingrained ideological conditioning there that this kind of runs up against. And it's interesting to sort of see people when they ask questions or I have conversations with them, sort of trying to work through getting beyond some of that while not feeling like they are, I don't know where I was going with that, but basically trying to work through that. So, you know, part of what I'm trying to do is really get it across to people that, you know, a lot of why people think of like free speech absolutism as this kind of sacred value when actually it doesn't even exist apart from the question of anti-fascism, and think through how, you know, there is a specific Anglo-American political tradition that has embedded these values. These are not universal, timeless values that, you know, we can look at other parts of the world and other times and places where people have just been like, you know what, these are Nazis, we need to shut them down. I think that's been a useful conversation. The second part of the question was about strategies, or what was
yeah,
it?
Just some, you know, based on what you've seen, what kind of strategies do you think that we should be thinking about broadly within this current period?
Well, I mean, it, of course, strategies all depend on what the goals of a group
sure.
would be, but I think that at least, if for the sake of argument, we want to think of what strategies would be useful for bridging a divide for leftists or community members that are on the fence about these politics, it seems to be useful to have situations where there are opportunities for different kinds of folks to plug in different kinds of ways. And I think that, for example, the opposition in Charlottesville or in Berkeley, where, you know, there's a militant anti-fascist faction, there's other people from unions and other kinds of groups and members of the community that show up and are there as well. This kind of, I think, broad coalition format. You know, talking about the Battle of Cable Street of 1936, when over 100,000 anti-fascists blocked the British Union of Fascists from marching through the East End of London, which was a Jewish neighborhood, that's like a historical example that I think really resonates with a lot of people because they can imagine doing the same thing today. And I think that these examples that kind of show how you can kind of blend or overlap militancy with popular participation in a way that has very clear objectives is something that I've seen resonating with people. But of course, that relies on situations where the far right is going to amass. And it's not clear after the destruction of the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville when they're going to do that and whether they're going to get the numbers for that to make sense. But that seems to be a way, in my limited experience, to sort of combine all these elements in a way that people are really interested in.
One last kind of big overarching question. You've described anti-fascism, you've described anti-fascism correctly as a pan-left movement. You also identify as an anarchist and you have for a long time. Do you think they're just thinking that like back at like the situation in Spain in the 1930s and the problems of kind of like you know, the popular United Front with communist groups and stuff. What do you think anarchists specifically should be thinking about, like, as we engage in anti-fascist organizing with other leftists?
Right. I mean, I think that the general pan-radical orientation of anti-fascism is important, and we can see what happens if we don't get on the same page to fight the common enemy. And I think that that priority is important. But, you know, that's sometimes easier said than done. And what that kind of unity looks like organizationally, tactically, strategically, is often something that's sorted out in difficult and contentious ways. I do think, though, that it is important as well, as you point, to look at examples like the Spanish Civil War, or even, you know, in a different context, the Russian Revolution, to see that while we, in the context of fighting fascism, can put aside our vision of the future, we can put aside differences around electoral politics and the state and so forth, those differences come into view the closer we get to achieving those kinds of goals, and the kind of potential conflicts break out at that time. We are very far away, unfortunately, from those things being immediately relevant. So I think certainly the anti-fascist perspective on unity is important. But anarchists, just as, I mean, Marxists, anyone, no one should give up their politics in doing this, and having conversations about it is important, recognizing that there are some very important tensions in this. And the other thing, though, that I think is fascinating is that really, if you think about militant anti-fascism of the post-war as a direct action-focused rejection of turning to the state or the police to solve the problem of the far right, and kind of a rebuke to the tendency of most European socialist and communist parties to look to the state to solve the problem of the far right, you can see that it has sort of an anarchistic orientation to it in its rejection of the state and legislation. And so it's interesting, I think, to see social democrats and other people whose politics is premised on transforming society through the state gravitating to some extent to militant anti-fascism. I'm not sure what to make of that entirely, but nevertheless, there is something about this that I think is directly connected to an anarchistic kind of politics, or at the very least an anti-authoritarian politics. And anarchists should, I think, use that to express their ideas, but also work with those they disagree with. And if things get to the point in the future where these tensions emerge, then that's just what it'll be.
You know, you're a historian. In your other talks, like on Democracy Now! Or other places, you've discussed the connections between, you know, what happened in the 1930s with now. I'm just curious, you know, looking back on history and then also looking at what's happening with the Trump administration now, you know, losing lots of support, losing lots of legitimacy. Is there a parallel within history of where we're at now, or what kind of things would history kind of like offer a light onto today?
Well, you know, it's tough to draw connections across big eras of history. But, you know, what I come back to a lot is how when Hitler took power, when Mussolini took power, the percentage of Italian or German society that self-identified as a Nazi or a fascist was actually very small. And a lot of the people who joined their parties did so for professional reasons, for familial reasons, or what have you. So, you know, fascist politics, and this is also to some extent true of left politics, where, you know, during the Spanish Revolution in Spain in the 1930s, a lot of people joined the CNT or participated in collectivized workplaces, not necessarily because they ideologically believed in anarchism, but because the kind of mode of politics fit in a common sense way with how they needed to live their lives. So in that sense, if you look at as we were talking about at the outset, the influence of the far right, of alt-right, alt-light, Breitbart, etc., on the Trump administration shows that if we're not vigilant, these kinds of ideas, even if they're originally espoused by a small group, can come to influence policy, can come to influence broader discourses around xenophobia and opposition to affirmative action and anti-immigrant sentiment. And so, you know, it's hard to say what the future will look like, but I think one of the lessons to take away from it is that if they gain momentum, even a small amount of momentum, people will unfortunately sometimes gravitate to these fascist ideas and these fascist groups for reasons that aren't necessarily ideological. And that's why, of course, anti-fascists are right in saying that you need to stop them before they take the first step in that direction.
Well, awesome. Thanks so much for joining us. Is there anything else you want to say or anything else we haven't covered that you want to talk on? And also, where can people buy your book and where are you speaking next?
Sure. The book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, if you Google it, there are online sites. You can buy it from the publisher or you can buy it from AK Press, who are distributing it. So that would be a good idea. I'm speaking on October 7th in Rochester, October 8th in Pittsburgh. But if you Google me and my tour, you can find I'm going out to Minneapolis and back. And I just want to thank It's Going Down for being awesome. You're doing great work.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining us and really appreciate just kind of stepping in front of the limelight and really just sharing your perspective. It's, I think a lot of people feel it's really been helpful.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
All right. Have a good one.
You too. What makes you think that this is okay? What makes you think you're a superior race? What makes you think that this is alright? I know you're right. It's your brain.